when our family moved to Vancouver in the 70s, not a lot of our relatives have heard of Vancouver. I remember the City Hall people voted down rapid transit because they didn't want Vancouver to grow into a big city. They wanted to keep it a quiet place for people to retire to. Well, that thinking changed in the 80s with the Expo. So the new plan was to get Vancouver on the world map. And ever since then, we have consistently been voted one of the top cities people want to move to if they could. And of course, one of the things that makes this city so interesting is the diverse mix of people and cultures from all over the world and the foods and flavors that they bring here. But as we know, diversity can be as challenging as it is interesting. It's more complicated to get things done because there are more opinions. It takes longer for everyone to be heard when we all come with different values and ideas and different ways of doing things. Our church plant used to have this mailbox in a gift shop near my house. The last time I was in there to close the mailbox, I found out the Korean owners decided to retire. And they introduced me to this man from Bangladesh who bought the gift shop from them. So the new owner and I chatted for about 15 minutes. He had lived in Toronto before moving here. And because it was election time, he offered his political views. And for some reason, what he said surprised me. It wasn't what I expected. I realized I had some assumptions about this man simply because of some stereotypes about where he came from when I really knew nothing about him. A famous psychologist says, any attempt at classification will create stereotypes. We all have them about people. I don't think we can help it. We just need to be aware when we're painting with a broad brush, when we assume we already know someone even before we meet them, and miss actually getting to know who they really are and their uniqueness as individuals. And this is the challenge in a big city home to lots of immigrants, to get past our stereotypes and actually get to know our neighbors, and no easy answers on how to get along, not for us, not for London or New York or Rio. Corinth was one of the greatest cities in the ancient world, the kind of place where people wanted to move to if they could, looking for a better life. It was California during the gold rush. Corinth was a narrow stretch of land between two oceans, the Aegean Sea to the east and the Ionian Sea to the west. And cargo runners paid big money to dock their ship on one side and have their ships dragged on wheels over land to the other side of Corinth and dropped into the other ocean. This saves them time and also the risk of shipwreck from having to sail around the Cape of Greece. So ship dragging was labor intensive. And so, like all wealthy places in the ancient world, Corinth's wealth was made off the backs of a lot of slaves. They did all the heavy lifting in everyday life that made life good for the rich upper class. But before Corinth was invaded by the Romans, when it was still Greek, the wealthy rich had a lot of civic pride. So instead of building mansions for themselves, the rich invested in infrastructure for people. So they built theaters and baths and temples, which all made Corinth the interesting place it was. So Corinth was a great place to shop, to catch a show, the best pastry apparently. And it was also famous for their red light district. The Greeks were not prudish people. The upper-class Greek men regularly got together for a dinner-slash-sex-party called the Symposion. It's held in a special room in the house with a little cubbyhole door. And it's a time to bond over an evening of drinking and orgy and debate and philosophizing. Once the door to the symposium room is shut, the only things that went in were jugs of wine passed through the little cubbyhole, and prostitutes. And then for the regular folks, there were plenty of temples in Corinth with sex priestesses to facilitate fertility rituals. Now, 140 years before Jesus, the Roman army showed up at the gates and invaded them. The Corinthians tried to put up a fight, but the only thing that did was to make the Romans mad. So the Romans leveled the place to the ground. The Romans didn't much care for the nicer things in Corinth or the artsy culture. So the Romans were pragmatic about getting things done the Roman way. Someone compared Roman society to a beehive. At the top, there's the 1%, the queen bee and her drones, lounging around making babies. And then there are all the other bees, the workers, who do all the work, building the hive, maintaining the hive, making food, nursing baby bees. So when the Romans rebuilt Corinth, mansions went up for the Roman elite. The theater was flooded for military mock sea battles. And the Roman culture widened the gap between social classes between the rich and the poor. The aristocrats from the working class, from the slaves. Everybody in the empire had their place and their jobs. And just like the bees, they were quick to gang up and turn on anyone who dared to step out of line and buck the status quo. The Romans were cliquish and snobbish. And the people at the top had all the power and would not hesitate to blow things up, which was how the Roman Empire got so big and successful. So in Acts 18, we have the story of when Paul came to Corinth and planted a church. He was here for about 18 months. The Jewish people tried to make trouble for him. The leader of the synagogue got beaten up for not being tougher with Paul. And so Paul, at that point, left town to avoid more trouble. But the church plant grew and found themselves with a good problem that every church planter wants. People were joining from all walks of life. And now the challenge is, how do you weave all the ethnic and social diversity into a well-functioning church? A community that holds and lives out Jesus' core values in common, on mission for God as agents of blessings and good news. So in other words, how do they cultivate unity? So people would genuinely care for and respect each other when people coming into the church had been programmed to relate to each other in the Roman way, which was cliquish and snobbish, and were quick to punch each other in the face. Well, sometime after Paul left Corinth, he got a letter from them, and oh my, things were not going well. We don't have a copy of that letter, but we have 1 Corinthians, which is Paul writing them back. And so we can reverse engineer what they had said to Paul. And basically, they bragged to Paul about things they should have been ashamed of and things they were turning a blind eye to that really undermined Jesus' message of love and blessing. What happened in the church in Corinth is what happens with all of us, that we don't become like Jesus instantly the moment we become Christian and join the church. And instead, we for a long while continue to do what comes naturally to us. And in Corinth, what came naturally to them was the Roman way. So, for example, in the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, what Paul says to them tell us that they were forming warring cliques around the different teachers and preachers, the way Romans backed different generals. And then in chapters 5 to 7, Paul rebukes them for messy sexual hookups in the church that made even the pagans blush. Paul's words. They were ruining marriages and leaving hurt feelings between friends. And then chapters 8 to 10, Paul mediates a heated argument about whether it was okay to eat the barbecue at the pagan feast. The rich people in church were judging the poor people for being unspiritual because they go to the feast looking for bargain meats. And then in chapters 11 to 14, Paul puts down some rules for orderly worship, because worship gathering in Corinth had degraded into shouting matches. Some people would yell out in tongues, maybe to advance an argument with direct messages they were supposedly getting from God. There was so much judging and arguing over everything that the church became some sort of spiritual Olympics. Everyone competing for a podium spot for being more right, more spiritual, and more enlightened by God. And everyone was jockeying to get to the top 1% of the church. This was the Roman way, a people who would Greco-Roman wrestle each other just for the fun of it. The Christians in Corinth didn't get how the church was supposed to be a different way to organize society. Not like the Romans' wealth and power hierarchy. And it all came to blow during the community dinners. So apparently, by this time, Christians were doing a Christian version of the symposion, minus the many jugs of wines and the prostitutes. They call it the agape, the love feast, a sort of potluck dinner before communion to cultivate bonds of friendship and camaraderie and learning in the church. But people did what came naturally to them. They sorted the church into layers and sat in their cliques. The aristocrats stuck to their own kind, the merchants and bankers to their own kind, and the slaves and laborers are pushed to the cheap seats. There was a similar problem described in James, when Roman social class snobberies got replicated in the church. The historian Thomas Cahill wrote this, capturing some of Paul's snarky critique. He writes, "Paul is not so unrealistic as to expect that all members of the community should have the same income, but he would have no part in treating anyone according to income. Within the community of believers, everyone is to be treated equally. But the Corinthians have taken the agape, the love feast that was held in the local house church prior to communion, and turned it into a textbook demonstration of economic inequality. The agape was meant to for sharing food and thoughts and strengthening the bonds of community. But the Corinthians, in their positive genius for getting things back to front, have made the house church agape into an opera house of economic distinction. From elegant box seats for the well-heeled to the out-of-the-way railings for the standees. I cannot congratulate you," says Paul between clenched teeth. "While one goes hungry, another gets drunk. Don't you have homes of your own for this sort of thing? Or have you such contempt for God's church that you can parade shamelessly in front of those who have nothing? What do you expect me to say to you? Congratulations? Not this time." So this is when Paul pulls out the body analogy that we read today in 1 Corinthians 12, starting in verse 12. Where Paul basically says, everyone in church is equally important, just like every organ is important and they work together in our body. Because just as our bodies work according to God's design, it is God who put us together in church on purpose. Everyone has a function that is indispensable for the health and function of the whole church. There is no expendable and worthless person in church. And not only that, a person whom the world thinks weak, church must empower them through fellowship. A person the world looks down on, the church must embrace them and esteem their dignity. And a person the world thinks not much to look at, a church must show off their beauty. So the historian continues, in other words, those who recognize the body and therefore recognize that everyone they meet is part of Christ are obliged above all else to charity, to the selfless love of everyone who falls across their path. Now for us in 2022, after 2,000 years of Christianity in Canada, there's nothing that revolutionary to us about what Paul says here. It sounds like things written into our constitution and other Western nations. But the Romans in Paul's time would have laughed at him because the Romans hated weakness and powerlessness. The idea of inherent human dignity and worth is ridiculous. It was a Roman imperative to look down and stomp on the people under you in the Roman social pyramid. Now, 500 years before Paul wrote this, before Rome became an empire, the working class people in Rome went on strike and the economy ground to a halt. They were upset that the government, made up of aristocrats, were ignoring the welfare of the common people and were simply looking after their own interest. Well, the strike got the attention they wanted. The rich people were basically helpless without the people who cooked their food and emptied their latrines. Garbage was piling up in the stench was building. So the consuls and the Senate got together to figure out how to get the people back to work. And one of the consuls, a Menenius Agrippa, made a speech comparing Roman society to a human body. Sounds familiar? But this speech, recorded by the Roman historian Livy, had a very different point than Paul's. He compared the Roman aristocrats to the stomach and everyone else the different organs. And he said the organs were complaining how they did all the work and thought the stomach was getting a free ride. So the organs stopped feeding the stomach to punish it. But the organs were short-sighted. They forgot where their food came from. Because if the stomach didn't get fed, there would be no nutrients coming to the organs either, and pretty soon the organs themselves would starve and become weak and lethargic. So it was actually in the organs' best interest to go back to work for their own well-being. The working folk should just accept the fact that life was unfair, but this was how the body worked, because that was the Roman natural order of things. Eventually, the Roman government did cave to some reforms, but in Paul's time, every learned person studied the speech, which said that inequality was normal and necessary for a well-functioning society. And what Paul does is that he takes this famous analogy and makes the opposite point, that actually the Roman natural order of things was not in fact natural, that there is a Christian alternative that goes back to how God designed the world. What Paul writes here is the first time ever in civilization when somebody puts in print that all humans on earth are created equal and have inherent dignity and rights, regardless of income, social status, or influence or celebrity, because we are all wonderfully and purposefully created by the same God. The British historian Tom Holland says how we know human rights and equality is a Christian idea. It's how they're clearly not shared by countries that are not founded on Judeo-Christian principles and values. Paul insists there are no sorting of people in church with any kind of man-made rules, what James calls favoritism. Instead, everyone in church must be respected and recognized for their essence and contribution to our ministry and personality. Did you know a 747 has 6 million parts? Which bolt do you think is unnecessary? In 1979, some people doing maintenance on a plane were lazy and cut some corners, and they didn't know that they had damaged some part of the wing. And during flight, a crack opened up on the wing and one bolt got overloaded. The bolt broke, the engine fell off, and the plane crashed. In the movie Amadeus about Mozart played this lively concerto for his patron, and the patron seemed confused by Mozart's music because it didn't sound like everything else at the time. So he said to Mozart, "It's nice, but do you think there are too many notes? Maybe you can take out a few." And a very snarky Mozart replied, "Which notes do you think I should remove?" There's an English theologian who compares the Trinity of Father, Son, and Spirit to a three-note chord. We can hear each note distinctly, but we can also hear the chord, which is the sound the three notes create together. The chords The chord sounds distinct as a chord, but the sound of the chord doesn't cover up the sound of the individual notes. We hear each note and we hear the chord all at the same time. So maybe a community that takes after God, Father, Son, and Spirit is like a chord with many notes. Jazz. We each carried a note which can be heard distinctly, and together we make a chord. Whenever a new note shows up in church, if the church is just happy to be the chord they already are, then there's really no room for the new note to bring whatever that note brings. So church may even feel threatened or disrupted and push the new note away. But if the church is willing to become another chord, a different one, by welcoming and encouraging the new note to sing, then some new chord would emerge, different than the one before, more than what they were before. And this is the challenge of growing churches: how to stay anchored and flexible at the same time, to encourage diversity and differences, yet united enough to organize and mobilize as a community of good news and blessings, but not so entrenched in our ways that we require people to give up their uniqueness before we would let them in. So how are you with differences and the unfamiliar? Because there are two kinds of people. People who thrive on encountering new things, and those who like things to stay the same and get really stressed when things are not done in the way they're used to. I'm of that second sort. I'm not good with new things. And one reason I decided I should travel more was to force myself to adapt to different things. So about 10 years ago, I tagged along with a friend when I found out she was going to Paris. Paris is sort of famous for the way they do things differently than us, like how Parisians eat dinner really late, so restaurants don't even open until like 7 or 8. So there's this restaurant I like there. Good food, affordable price, and I went back a few times during my trip. So I was the first one in this one night at 7 when these three older couples walked in. They were speaking American English, and they were dressed like people ready for golf. Well, from the way this one man and one woman spoke to the server, I could tell they have been stretched beyond their limits for adventure during their vacation abroad. So one man asked for water and then added with some exasperation, "Could you put some ice in it, please?" And then when the bread came, the same man said, "Could you give us some butter, please?" Well, apparently they have had it with the tepid tap water and the plain baguettes, which is how they do it over there. And then after looking over the menu, the entrees of fresh dishes the chef whipped up from things he found at the market that morning, the fresh fish, the terrine, the pork tenderloin, that woman let out a sigh and said to the server, "Do you have any chicken?" I confess, I almost laughed out loud. Now compare them to this other couple I met in another restaurant. I was again the first one in for dinner, and then these two from California got seated next to me, and they introduced themselves and told me they were taking a train to the wine country. Well, seconds later, my table and their table and the one next to them of a couple from Ottawa, we got pushed together and we turned into a party. And these two Californians started telling us about all the foreign things they've been experiencing and how everything was so good and fantastic, and how they deeply appreciated how the French did things. And I couldn't help but admire them for their approach to new things, their openness and curiosity and wonder compared to me and the other people at that other restaurant. And then we have the two mindsets for doing church together. We're either fighting to keep things the way we like it, or we're curious and appreciative of new energies and ideas and gifts that new people bring into our fellowship. There's a church in California. They say whenever they interview for a new staff, they always take the candidates out for lunch at the weirdest restaurant they can find, just to see how they react to the unfamiliar. And if that person tenses up and gets real uncomfortable, they know right away that person wouldn't be a good fit for the church, because they're looking for people who are curious for their team, so the church would stay open and curious. If our world is more equal now and encodes basic human rights into our constitutions, it's because of Jesus' revolutionary ideas about human dignity and worth, explained to us here by Paul with his version of the body analogy. But the analogy only gives us God's vision for the church. It doesn't do the hard work of being church for us. It's not easy to reprogram our brains from what is ingrained in us by the world. Our cliquey and snobbish tendencies, our competitive nature, and our need to be more right than others. The world requires people to change and assimilate if they want to fit in and be included. And if they don't, they're not welcomed. But Paul tells us the church needs to see each other, each new person, as sent by God, bringing with them something new that will change the status quo, because it's change God thinks the church needs. And he wants us to embrace and welcome what that person brings. This is the good problem of a growing church. If that's what people want, if the church is willing to put in the work again to find a new sound every time a new person joins, so that new person joining gets to be themselves, seen and heard, and be added to the mix, and we find a new sound that is richer and different and more complex, it's the new thing God is doing among us. And it's hard work of church that never ends. Do we really want it? If we do, are we willing to do the work to make it so? Christianity doesn't offer easy answers to how that happens, but Paul insists that how we get along with our diversity is how we show the difference the gospel makes. According to this theologian, the way we work at it and how much we want it is the evidence of gospel being released among us, he says. He writes this: it's naive to think that one can function with the simple formula, people have problems, and the gospel resolves them. The fact is, the gospel generates in individual lives and society a new set of problems. Invite people of different social and economic backgrounds around the same table, and the fellowship is strained, often breaking apart. Plant the cross in the room and the upwardly mobile convert it into a ladder. Evil, by whatever name it's called, will not sit idly by and allow the gospel to transform a community when having to deal with those problems, which clearly have their origins in the fact that the gospel has been released in the community. A difference is being made, and that is seldom without pain. The first time I went singing, a group of 33 of us on a bus, I was the only Canadian and I was the only Asian. The leader, Dan, made it a point to have coffee with each person one-on-one. When it was my turn, I didn't know what to expect when he said, "You know, you have an advantage because you look different. People's first impression of you is that you're interesting because you have lived somewhere else and you have seen things they haven't." Now, growing up here as an immigrant, I have been made to feel different and foreign plenty of times. But no one has ever told me before that my differences made me interesting. Here is someone who saw my uniqueness and was not threatened by me, but wanted to get to know me. And him seeing me for me changed my life. How I think about myself and how I feel about myself and what I thought I'm capable of becoming. And I would say that was the day when I started to see myself the way God had in mind when he thought me up. Our passage today in verse 13 begins with, "For we were all baptized by one spirit so as to form one body, whether Jews or Gentiles, slave or free. And we were all given one spirit to drink." The drinking picture is communion at the agape meal. It is Paul reminding us that God doesn't ask us to be church without giving us help from his Spirit. The Spirit is the one building the church. We just need to cooperate and follow his lead. Every time we eat that bread and drink that cup, we're to remind ourselves of our objective as church, to join our individual uniqueness and gifts into becoming one coordinated people of God in service of the world, in love and generosity. And God's Spirit in us joins us together. In chapter 15, Paul finishes his letter talking about resurrection. And Paul reminds us that one day we will each get a new body, new hardware for us. But God is also in the process of raising a new humanity. And how we learn to get along with each other now is the foundation for our future relationship with each other for eternity. So even though it's messy now learning to be church, this is how the Spirit is writing new software in us. So not only will our bodies get an upgrade, so will our souls. They will know us by our love. The song says, the world would only believe whether God really loves them by how we take care of each other. Maya Angelou said this about authenticity, and I think what she said about a person can be applied to a church. She says, I don't trust people who say they love me if they don't love themselves. Be wary of a naked man offering you a shirt. Let me give you a moment to begin a conversation with God. And then I'll read you something of the original vision for church. So here's Luke taking a snapshot of the first church community in Acts 2:44. It's how it all started. It's my favorite thing to read before communion. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Amen.